Okay. Thank you, Mark. I'm going to take this off. My name is Russell Spatz. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the South Dixie group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I haven't found that I should have a drink, nor have I had a drink since January 25th, 1981. I'm grateful to God for that, and it's great being here. I got a call from, I'm not sure who I got, who called me up? Was it Mike or John? Did you call me up and said, do you want to come on up to New York and do a few meetings? And I said, sure, I'll visit my son in D.C. along the way, see some grandkids, and it's great to be here. I'm an old New York kid, and I moved down about 53 years ago to Miami, and I've been down there ever since, but it's good to be here among friends. I've met some new friends. Got Jesse over there. And as I was driving over here, John was, hi, Morris, how you doing? It's good to see you. Sit on down. I actually sponsor Morris. He moved away to New Jersey from Miami. I told him not to do that, but but you know, like most of my sponsors, he ignored me. That's Mario, who I sponsored down in Miami. He happened to be in Midtown, and I haven't spoken to him in 3 years, ever since he got over the cancer. You know, and that's where you meet God, in the valleys. And he called me up from Midtown and said, what are you doing? I said, come on, let's go to a meeting. So I have some sponsees here and different people here, and you know, we all go through things, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about my life. And you don't have to agree with me or disagree with me. It doesn't matter. It has nothing to do with you guys. It has to do with me, you know. I got people come up to me. You know how people come up to you and say, you're talking about me? I say, no, I'm talking about me. I used to think one of the, you know, it says, unless and until an alcoholic accepts his alcoholism and all its consequences, his sobriety will be precarious. And if true happiness, he'll find none at all. And there's a lot of consequences to being an alcoholic that have nothing to do with drinking. And they have to do with a way of thinking. One of the consequences of being an alcoholic is feeling like you're isolated, you're alone, and nobody understands you except for you because you're completely different. When the truth is we're exactly like each other and we're all twins. And every thought I've had, you've had, and whatever thought you've had that you're not sharing with anybody because you don't think nobody would ever understand, they think you're terrible. I've had those thoughts too. And we do some pretty good sharing in Alcoholics Anonymous. We share about 80% of all our thoughts, 20% we're going to die with because we know that they wouldn't even appreciate it. They wouldn't understand it, but we all got the same stuff going on. It's all crazy, crazy stuff. I sponsored a guy once named Tommy H. I still sponsor him. He's got like 30 years, and we were colleagues together in the state's attorney's office. I was a former division chief with him with Janet Reno, and he called me up one time. He had sunk all the way down, and he had lost just about everything. And he called me up. He was sucking in the barrel of a shotgun. And I took him to his first AA meeting, and he came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and he took to it like a duck takes the water. Saved his life. You know, within 2 days, he got a haircut, changed into the old Tommy again, and he just loved it. It like saved his life. He like turned around, you know, stopped drinking, still hasn't had a drink. About a month sober, he was driving in Tampa, and he had done a terrible thing. It happens to alcoholics. He had started thinking again. You ever do that? You know, you want to stay away from that thinking stuff. You know, I finally got past that after about 15 years. You'd be surprised how well you can get in life. You'd be surprised how well you can get along in life if you just tone down the thinking. I've never met anybody in AA that didn't suffer from some sort of depression or some sort of anxiety where there wasn't a whole lot of thinking that happened before that. And so he had been thinking, and he had been sober for about a month, and he called me up and he said, I think I have to leave AA. And I said, Tommy, what are you talking about? You're doing great. You love AA. He says, I know, but I think I have to leave. I'm not sure. I don't think I'm an alcoholic. I said, you don't think you're an alcoholic? He says, no. He says, I think I may just be crazy. I said, Tommy. He says, what? He said, you can be both. He was incredibly relieved to hear that, and he stayed in AA, and everything is working out now. So I want to promise you that you can be both. You know, so if it's 3 o'clock in the morning and you got 1,000 voices in your mind telling you what a piece of crap you are and you're going to die and nothing's going to be okay, and you know it can't be drink because you haven't had a drink in 18 months or 3 months, whatever it is, don't worry. That's just alcoholism. It'll go away in about 20 or 30 years. You'll be fine. Okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit about my life and what my deal is, and I'll tell you, I've been sober a little over 34 years, and I'm just reporting, I'm not bragging, and so you got to understand, I've road tested this thing pretty much. I've road tested going through life physically sober. I've road tested dealing with alcoholism, not the drinking part, you know, which really has very little to do with alcoholism. That's just, you know, I never suffered. I didn't really know what alcoholism was until I stopped drinking, because how do you know what alcoholism is when you drink all the time to avoid it? You know, I know about drunk. I knew about drunk. You know what I mean? I would say things like, anybody ever say I need a drink? I used to think I need a drink and say, and when I said I needed a drink, it wasn't like, well, wouldn't it be nice to have a drink? It was like, pull the flipping car over. I need a drink now. And I needed a drink because I needed a drink. And if you're an alcoholic, you understand what it's like to need a drink where you have to have a drink. I used to get relief pulling up to the bar. Pulling up to the bar, I'd start feeling better. You know, just thinking about a drink, I'd feel better. And so the drinking, it says in the big book, it says men and women drink because they like the effect produced by alcohol. They're restless, they're irritable, they're discontented. By the way, sober, unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. You know, I drank because I couldn't stand sobriety. Carl Menninger in the 1930s wrote a book, Man Against Himself, and in the chapter on alcoholism, it says men and women are alcoholics. Alcoholics are men and women who are out to destroy themselves. I don't care whether you have the money, whether you don't have the money, whether you're doing well, whether you're not doing well, whatever it is, the bottom line is it all ends up in the end as, why is this happening to me? This is a bunch of crap. I want to kill myself. You know, there's just something missing. And so I need. And what's happened is, after, you have to understand, I came today when I was 31 years old. I'm 66 now. So I drank for about 15, 16 years, and I've been sober for about 34 years. So, you know, I was told before I came in that your story will change. You know, when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous, my drunkalogue was like, you know, 45 minutes, you know what I mean? And then what happened was like 5 minutes, and what it's like now was like 10 minutes. And now, although I understand the drunkalogue is important for identification, trust me, I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be coming up here if it wasn't the fact that I'm an alcoholic. My drunk stories are like 5 minutes, 10 minutes. What I really want to talk about is I want to talk about physical sobriety. I want to talk about the solution. I want to talk about experiencing much of heaven and being rocking in the fourth dimension of existence, which you had not even dreamed, because I sponsor a lot of guys with 15, 16, 20 years, 25 years sobriety who are thumb-sucking crybabies, although you wouldn't know because they know how to play the A game. They know how to talk and sound good in A meeting, but the bottom line is they're on their 17th divorce. They're not talking to their kids. They're still worried about money. They're still worried about what other people think about them, and they're not free. And they're not experiencing that sense of ease and comfort. You know, they're not experiencing the stuff that we're supposed to experience. That deal in the big book, it says, see that your relationship with God is right and all things will work for you, and you'll just be propelled. They're not experiencing everything AA has to offer because they're just with the not drinking crew. You know, there's two different doors in AA. One door says not drinking crew, one not drinking club, and there's another door that says rocking the fourth dimension. You know, experiencing much of heaven, rocking the fourth dimension, of which you had not even dreamed. And there's thousands of people in front of the not drinking door. We all line up next into the not drinking door, and there's maybe three or four people next to the rocket in the fourth dimension door. And every once in a while, you see somebody go from the not drinking side to the rocketed side, but you very rarely see anybody go from the rocketed side to the not drinking side. So I want to talk about what it's like and how to experience and what it's like and what's happened to me since I've been sober. I'm going to tell you a few drinking stuff. Because alcoholism really, the drinking is really what I, hey listen, I drank because no woman, no clothes, no amount of money, no job, no nothing ever worked quite as well for me, quite as fast as just a few drinks. And if alcohol did for me what it did for me when I was 18 years old, I'd still be drinking it. But the deal with me is alcohol stopped working for me. And the real sad deal about my life is alcohol stopped working for me about 10 years before I realized it stopped working for me, and I hurt a lot of people. And so it don't work for me anymore, so I had to stop drinking it. And I drank alcohol because I couldn't stand being sober. Because sober wasn't good enough. Sober was never good enough. And I understand now after not drinking, I'll tell you, if you don't drink, after a month or two or three or four, you'll realize why you drank. It'll come to you at 3 o'clock in the morning. You'll say, now I know why I drank that shit. Because I want to commit suicide right now. Because what drinking is it's a way of killing yourself. Because if you're a drunk and if you're an alcoholic, life is so bad at times that you just want to die. But the problem is you just don't want to die. So drinking is a way of committing suicide, but you get to wake up in the morning. It's a coward's way of committing suicide. It's what you do when you want to die and you want to kill yourself because you can't stand the way things are, but you'd rather continue breathing so you can just die for, you know, about 6 hours and wake up the next morning. That's the deal. At least that's the deal for me. So I'm going to tell you a few stories. And, you know, I was driving over here and John was telling me, he says, because, you know, I've got these tapes out on rocket.org, and he was telling me, he says, I want you to, because he's listened to all of them, and he said, I want you to tell the story about the miners, I want you to tell Chicken on the Roof, I want you, he's got all the, these stories are like your baby. You know, I've been talking for like 30 years, so I've got like 3,000 stories, it's all about my life. I mean, they're true things. So he's naming off about 10 stories he wants me to tell. And I said, well, you know, that'll take 4 hours, you know. And then I rented the Jesse, who drove up about an hour and a half from New Jersey. And he said, you know, I'd like you to, could you tell these four stories, you know, my favorite stories and that kind of stuff. I said, well, I can add those on to John's stories. That's 10 stories. That's 6 hours, you know. And so it's going to go wherever it's going to go. And I'm going to talk about whatever I'm going to talk about. And a lot of stuff is, you know, when you've been sober for 34 years, there's a lot of stories, not to mention stuff that happened beforehand. And I'll just tell you a few things and probably leave that a lot, but you know, just a couple of deals. I when I was 15 years old, anybody ever see Playboy magazine? Any guy? I'm the only guy. I'm it. That's it. Okay. Okay. You know, the magazine you read like that, you know. And so when I was 15 years old, I got a Playboy magazine. I looked at it. I was sober when I looked at it, and I realized immediately what I needed to be okay. That sort of thing, I chased that thing. Believe me, I wanted what she had. I was willing to go to any length to get it. I chased that thing for years, knowing that if I had one of those, I'd be okay. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was sitting with my sponsor one time, and I said, you know how it is in AA? I said, look at the gal in the front row. Look at that blonde in the front row. And my sponsor said, he said to me, he said, what did you like to drink? I said, I like scotch. He said, what kind of scotch? I said, J&B. He said, Russell, you see that gal in the front row? He says, yeah. He says, that's a bottle of J&B with legs for you. You know, he used to say underneath every skirt is a slip, you know, and he was right. And that's a whole other deal going on. That has to do with something called alcoholism. That has to do with needing something to put in your life because you have to have it because you're a piece of shit without it. Because I was a nothing. I was always going to be a nothing. I was never going to be anything but a nothing. It didn't matter that I had a law degree, that I was a National Science Foundation fellowship. It didn't matter that I was a division chief of the state's attorney's office. I was a nothing. I knew I was always going to be a nothing. I used to put something in my body. It would turn me into an almost. When you're nothing, almost is top of the world. And so one day when I was 15 years old, I saw that Playboy magazine, and I knew if I had that deal, that gal, that deal, that I would be okay. I would be something. That would make me something, because if you're an alcoholic, you are a nothing. You are never good enough. There is always something more you need to have in order to add something onto your body. I don't care if it's bigger boobs. I don't care whether it's, you know, erectile dysfunction. I don't care what the hell it is. There's something you need. I don't care if it's a blouse. I don't care what it is. There's something you need to get. You need, you have to have, you have to buy. Believe me, I've spent more money that I don't have buying crap I don't need to impress people I don't like than you can possibly imagine. I've maxed out credit cards because I need, I have to have. I can't lose. What will they think? Because all I do, if you're an alcoholic, that's one of the consequences of alcoholism. I'm always thinking about what other people are thinking about you. If you're an alcoholic, that's a consequence of being an alcoholic. Being an alcoholic is to live your entire life worrying about what other people think about you, and then telling yourself after thinking for 10 hours, what will other people think about you, and trying to manage yourself so that other people think good about you. After living your life for 10 hours, always thinking about other people and what they think about you, then telling yourself, I don't give a shit what other people think about me. That's what being an alcoholic is all about. You know what? I used to drink alcohol. You know what it lets you do? What alcohol lets you do is it lets you actually believe that you really don't give a crap what other people think about you. Man, if I put something in my body that I really didn't care what you thought about me, wouldn't it be great going through life where you really didn't care what other people thought about me? My whole life is about me. Me, 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 me. All I do is think about me. I didn't even know what love is before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're an alcoholic, alcoholics are romantics. They use love all the time, but I didn't really know what love was until I was maybe, I don't know, 5, 10 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a girlfriend named Lynn Benson. She came from New Jersey, you know, and as a matter of fact, and I was with her every day at the University of Miami for 1 year. Every day for 1 year. I had that great alky love, you know, alky love, where you're always thinking about the person, you're always imagining what the wedding's going to be like, what the kids are going to be like, how you love her and she loves you, always wanting to be with her, where's she going to be, what's she going to do. You know, well, some people call it love, I call it, you know, some people call it stalking, but, you know, I had that alky love going on in December. Because I loved her. I loved her. I mean, every gal I ever went out with, I fell in love with. I loved her. And then one day she said to me this. She said this. She said, Russell, my parents, who had been subsidizing her, you know, and I don't know how old I was, 19, 20, 21 years old. My parents, you know, want me to come home for Christmas. They want me to come home for Christmas for a few days because they would like to see me. And I immediately went into a rage. And I said this. But what about me? Let me tell you something. You can call it love all you want. You scratch the surface of this boy, you get what about me. It's always about me. I want to know about me. Let's talk about me. Let me tell you about me. Okay, enough about me. Enough about me, Jesse. Let's talk about you. What do you think about me? You know, I mean, it's all about me. That's if you're an alcoholic, it's selfishness, it's self-centeredness, it's selfishness, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking. We step on the toes of others, they retaliate. You know, usually we think for without reason, but we realize that we've made decisions based upon self, which puts us in a position to be hurt. And I made a lot of decisions based upon self. Even decisions I thought were the most virtuous, most of them were based upon self. Though he's self will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. Above all, we must get rid of this selfishness. We must, or it kills us. It kills us. The wrongdoings of others, real or imagined. Imaginary crap. That's the consequences of being an alcoholic. Imaginary crap that you worry about other people kills us. We must get rid of it, or it kills us. God makes that possible. Managing your life doesn't make that possible. Other people don't make that possible. God makes that possible. That's Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I mean, believe me, I have a great imagination, and I'm always thinking about myself, and of course I'm always thinking about what you're thinking about me, because I have that alcoholic paranoia where I'm convinced that everybody's always thinking about me. I'm like the two psychiatrists that passed each other in the hall. One says, you know, how are you doing? The other says, I wonder what he meant by that. You know, I mean, it's all bad shit about myself and other people. And so I got that Playboy magazine. Now, I knew if I had one of those gals, I'd be okay. If I had her, if I had this, if I could get one of them gals to like me or adore me, I'd be okay. And so the bottom line is, I'm looking around. In order to get one of those gals, you guys know you got to get a car, right? You got to get a car. You get a car, a good car, a cool car, because you got to be cool. That's very important to alcoholics. Be cool, because if cool, people will like you and they'll accept you. And if you're an alcoholic, you're a please love me a holic. Please accept me a holic. Why don't you like me a holic? Why did you treat me that way a holic? What do you think about me a holic? What did you say about me a holic? You're all those holics. You got all that stuff going on, you know? So the bottom line is, I got my, so when I was about 19 years old, I inherited some money and the new Camaros came out. It was 1970s, the sleepback Camaros. They were absolutely gorgeous. And I knew if I had that car, if I could get this, then I could get that, and I could have this, and I'd be that. And I stood in front of Panhandling Chevrolet, and I had about $6,000 to put down on a car. I don't know how much it was, $10,000, whatever it is, back then. And I went in there, and I bought the newest car, the first Camaro, right off the showroom floor. It was gold with a white Landau top. It was absolutely gorgeous. And I said, give me that car. It was a Friday. And he said, we can't give it to you. We got to prep it. I said, what do you mean prep it? He says, you paid. He says, no, we got to prep it. It's the law. We got to prep it. You can pick it up tomorrow at 9 o'clock. At 8 o'clock in the morning, I was camped outside the door because I had to have that car. Because if you're an alcoholic, you have to have it immediately. You need it now. I had to have it because that was going to be the thing that changes my life. Because if you're an alcoholic, that's the thing. You got to have that deal because it's going to work miracles in your life. The things, the material stuff, the gal, the guy, the money, the job, that's going to change your life. When if you're a whack job before the thing, you're a whack job after the thing. You know? You understand what I'm saying? Because you know what Bill Wilson said, emotional sobriety? He says the real problem with alcoholics, the next frontier, is that we have unhealthy dependencies on other people and things that we can't control. You know, and the bottom line, and that's the real nature of this disease. And the bottom line is, so I got that car, I jumped in that sucker. I bought that car, I jumped in that sucker. I was 19 years old, 20 years old. I was about 100 pounds lighter than I am right now. I had on my T-shirt, I had the cigarette, you know, I had it rolled up. I had the glasses on, the sunglasses on. I rolled out onto Alton Road, smoking a cigarette in one hand, sunglasses, arm out the window, you know what I mean? Driving the car like this, you know, with the radio blasting. You know that feeling, the new car thing, and the new Camaro, there was nothing like it on the road. There was like nobody on the road. It was 9 o'clock in the morning on Miami Beach. There was nobody on the road. I thought I was driving in Yankee frickin' Stadium, you know what I mean? I thought every woman in China, all billion of them, were watching me, like on Google Earth, you know? Look at me now. I'm okay. I'm just waiting for them to look at me. Look at me. The Hugh Hefner of Miami, you know? Sure, you're laughing. You don't know what it's like. So I got up to a red light. This is a true story. I get up to a red light. And some guy drives up, some old fart, some guy, he's probably about my age, 66, so some old guy drives up in a brand new Cadillac on the right-hand side. And he's like looking down at me, you know, because he's in the Caddy, I'm in the Camaro. He's looking down at me, and I'm looking up at him. He's looking at me, I'm looking at him. He's looking at me, I'm looking at him. Sitting next to him, the Playboy bunny. The bitch, you know what I mean? Because he had something obviously I didn't have, money, you know what I mean? It had to be that, it couldn't be anything else, what could it be, you know? And so he's there with his, I'm looking at him, he's looking at me, I'm looking at her, he's looking at me. I'm looking at the car, he's looking at me. And all of a sudden this thought crosses my mind. Why can't I have a car like that? The feeling lasted 3 blocks. The payments lasted 36 months. You know what that is, by the way? That's alcoholism. That envy, that coveting, that it's not enough, it's not good enough. Why don't I have this? Why don't I have that? This restlessness, this feeling that nothing's good enough. You know what that is? That's something called alcoholism. That's the thing that happens after. And if you use drinking to get rid of that stuff, guess what? After you stop drinking, it's still there. I mean, I can stop the drinking. How do you stop the thinking? That kind of deal. I was married to a wonderful young lady. My wife's not here tonight, so I can talk about that every time she's here. She couldn't make it tonight. She wasn't feeling well. I came up with her to New York. My wife's we've been married 34 years. She's a lady. She's a royalty in Al-Anon. Anybody know Al-Anon? Our Lady's of Perpetual Revenge. Yeah, she does a great Al-Anon 10 step. When I'm wrong, she promptly admits it. You know, and one of my granddaughters. I have 6 grandkids, and one of my granddaughters, she's like this tall. She's like 4 years old. She comes to see me and she says, "Grandpa," I said, "What is it, sweetie? What is it, Andrea?" He says, "What kind of fish are you?" I said, "I don't know, sweetheart. What kind of fish am I?" She says, "You're a selfish." I said, "Oh, you've been talking to Grandma." Yeah, well, you know, listen, I can't tell you how great my marriage got when I finally realized that I'm always wrong. When I finally realized, my sponsor used to say, would you like to be right or happy? I said, both. You know, I mean, you know, I'm not stupid. He says, you can't be both because you got to be right. You'll always have to have the last word. You'll always be pissed off. You'll always be fighting with somebody. And I said, well, I still didn't understand that. You know, because it's like everything else you learn in AA. You learn through trials and tribulations. You know, the 3 books that the old timers said, and Dr. Bob, the good old timer, that were absolutely essential. Absolutely essential. You know, they say, anybody ever read the big book where it says, rarely have I seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path, whatever their path was. You know what their path was? It had nothing to do with reading. You know when they wrote that? They wrote that in 1939. A started in 1935. A started in 1935. That book was written in 1939. They said, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly, not the way you wanted, not my program, your program, thoroughly followed our path. And I can tell you one thing, their path had nothing to do with reading the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a big book devotee. I'll quote it all the time. I got sober on the big book. But they did not use, they said, thoroughly followed our path, and I know what their path was, because in Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, they said the 3 books they found absolutely essential was the book of James, which our program was modeled after. We were almost called the James Club. Sermon on the Mount, you know, Matthew 5, 6, and 7, and Corinthians. 1 Corinthians 13, the love chapter. And all that stuff is packed into that deal. Packed into that deal. And, you know, I married this wonderful young lady, and who I affectionately call my first wife, and I became a graduate law school, became a division chief for one of our attorney generals, Janet Reno. I was prosecuting mostly murder cases, had a beautiful house in Miami Beach on the golf course, beautiful son. And I was bored. I was bored. Married 5 years, I was bored. I wanted to go out. You know what I wanted to go out? I wanted to go out and, excuse my language, get laid. She was a gorgeous gal. She was a beautiful gal. Perfect good right. Nothing wrong with her. You know what? But it wasn't working for me. You know why? Because I'm selfish. And you know why? Because I'm in touch with my feelings. You know, people say you got to get in touch with your feelings. Trust me, I was always in touch with my feelings. I never had a problem being in touch with my feelings. I didn't give a crap about your feelings, but I was in touch with my feelings. I knew exactly how I felt, why I felt the way I did, and my feelings. You know, alcoholics do worship God. They worship the God of their feelings. All they think about is their feelings. All they want to talk about is their feelings. And they don't want to talk about your feelings. They're waiting for you to stop talking so they can tell you how they feel. I was in love with, in touch with, and the only thing that was important to me, and my whole life was guided upon my feelings. And believe me, I don't know anything about doing the next right thing or any of that stuff, because the bottom line is, or practicing principles, all I know about is my feelings, and I'm going to end up doing, somehow, I'm a rationalizer. You understand? I tell myself rationalize. I will figure out, I am smart enough, intelligent enough to figure out how I can get done what I want to get done anyway based upon my feelings by rationalizing it away. I can rationalize keeping the money when I should give it back. I can rationalize making a phone call and yelling at you when I should probably shut up. I can rationalize doing a lot of things because I'm an alcoholic and what I care about is my feelings and all I care about is that I'm selfish and I can give a crap about your feelings. I don't even think about your feelings because you're not important because you're not me. And that, you know what that is? That's a consequence of being an alcoholic. So you can stop the drinking. How are you going to stop that stuff? How are you going to stop that stuff when it's like being right-handed? If you're an alcoholic, you know, you know how you stop that stuff? You know, you just have your brain taken out. Surgery. That happens between your ears. My alcoholism sentences in my mind, not my body. So I don't know how you take care of where did that selfishness. I don't know how you take care. I know how to tell an alcoholic. They say things like, they don't know who they're screwing with. Who the hell do they think they are? Why is this crap always happening to me? I'm a self-pityaholic. I always was a self-pityaholic. You know, I'm the guy who's sitting by the radio play, the record player, the LPs back then. Some of you guys remember that. Listening to the same song over and over again while I'm getting drunk. Thinking about my life, you know. Those LPs were tough because as you're drinking, I would listen to all these good alkie songs like Running on Empty and I Missed a Blue, anything by Karen Carpenter, Rainy Days and Mondays, you know. You know, all that stuff. And then you have to, then we get to the end, you got to swear, you know, bring it back. And, you know, I think about my funeral. Think about my funeral a lot. You know, I think about all those good looking gals that were gathered around at the casket, thinking about, you know, why they treated me the way they did. And, you know, yeah, bitch, you know, look at me. Now I'm dead. Now you feel sorry for you and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, sure, you're laughing. You don't know what it's like, you know. But the Bobby, that's alcoholism. That's alcoholism. That's self-pity. I don't need alcohol to do self-pity. I can do self-pity. Believe me, I can do self-pity without the booze. Anything that happens in this world, I can feel sorry for myself. It has to do with thinking. Everything I think about, 90% of the stuff I think about is nothing to do with me. And I can figure out some way to get into a depression thinking about something that happened 1,000 miles away that have nothing to do with me. Because all I do is think about me. So my wife tells me one day, my first wife tells me one day, she says this. It's a Friday. I'm in my blue pinstripe suit, my white shirt, my red tie, getting ready to drive across the causeway to Miami to start some sort of murder trial or something like that. Getting ready to drive in my fancy car out of my fancy house. And there she is with my son. And she says this to me. This is what she says to me. You ready? If you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. Okay, that's 12 words. If you come home drunk one more time, I am leaving you. 12 words. No fat. Listen, no fat there. You can't take out one word. I mean, there's no like, it's lean. It's lean. Now, listen, I graduated departmental honors in mathematics. You understand what I'm saying? I'm a division chief of the state's attorney's office. I'm trying murder cases. I'm doing all sorts of stuff, supervising attorneys. This is the simplest statement in the world. If you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. And she didn't want to start a fight. It was like she was delivering the mail. You understand? It was like, I just thought you ought to know. She just wanted to know. She wasn't going to take it. She had developed something apparently called self-esteem. You know, a rare quality in some gals. But in any event, she had developed that. Like, she didn't need to be married to somebody like that. If you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. And I heard it. I heard every word she said. And I got in my car and I drove about 3 blocks. Came to a light. And you know what I thought? I swear to God, this is the thought that went through my mind. What the hell did she mean by that? You know, alcoholics are like idiot, you know, idiot savants. You know what I mean? They don't get, you know, like when the judge says, I see you one more time in my courtroom, you're going to jail. They walk in and they say, what's that all about? You know what I mean? It's like, trust me, if you don't understand when the most important person in your life, who is or should be, your wife and your child and everything, says, you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. When that doesn't make any sense to you, you're headed for some sort of trouble in your life. You understand? Because whenever, now listen, here's the deal. And this, whenever an alcoholic, you wonder sometimes when you sponsor people, don't they understand? Don't they get it? No, they don't understand it. They don't get it. Whenever an alcoholic, if you suffer from alcoholism, whenever an alcoholic hears, sees, is told or reads something he doesn't like, it confuses him. He gets mad at it. He makes it go away. He gets pissed off. That's, you know what that is? You ready for this? That's something called alcoholism. That's alcoholism, and that survives not drinking. That goes on even after you stop drinking. It's like being right-handed. It's like, I don't know how many people are right-handed or left-handed. You know, you're right-handed, you're always right-handed. You never stop being right-handed. You never stop being left-handed. If I was to tell you, look, if you just, Russ, you're right-handed. If you just from now on do everything with your left hand, your life will be glorious. Glorious. So I said, that's crazy. It couldn't be that simple. Try it. So all of a sudden I chain my right hand. I just do everything with my left hand. The money's flowing in. The gals are flowing in. Everything's going great. I said, this left hand thing, this is unbelievable. I'm never going to stop using my left hand. 20 years down the road, some guy puts out his hand. He says, how you doing? I go, hey, fine. You know what I mean? Because I am intuitively somehow structured to sort of think crazy thoughts about myself and other people. That's what it means to be selfish and self-centered. You know, a thousand forms of fear, self-delusion. And the way I get a new perspective, I don't know how you got a new perspective, but it's unbelievably painful. By 100 humiliations, the final crushing of our self-sufficiency. That's how I get a new perspective. I get a new perspective in the valleys. When everything's going okay for me, believe me, I don't want to hear what you have to say. So that's what she said to me. And of course, I ended up, you know, she apparently wanted me, you ready for this? She wanted me to make a choice between her and my child and my house and the booze. Well, that was pretty easy. So after the divorce, you know what I mean? I mean, that's it. She tried to get me back, she said, well, maybe she should go to marriage counseling, because apparently, and I don't understand this stuff, the oath, you know that oath, you know, what is it? What do they say? Till death do us part, that crap, you know? Apparently, and she had great parents, she was a great gal, apparently that actually meant something. I think, you know, you ready? Any guys divorced in here? Listen, here's what, I know this is going to sound hard to believe. When women get married, I think that they actually think it's like forever. I don't understand that at all, but I think they do. You know, I did sort of, you know what I mean? But, you know, I was really looking forward to the party and the sex and stuff like that. But the bottom line is that apparently she thought it was like a forever thing. She took it seriously, and she wanted to get back together. She said, let's go to marriage counseling. And I had already been thinking about all those girls in China that I was going to go out with and all that sort of stuff and all the fun I was going to have and all the stuff I needed in my life to make me feel like a man. Because if you're an alcoholic, you know you're not a man. You know you're something else, but you're worried about somebody will find out that you're not a man or whatever it is, and you got to get laid in order to feel okay about yourself, because if you don't do that or do something or get a job or get money, you're a nothing. You might as well kill yourself or drink or something like that. I don't understand it, but it's some sort of crazy deal. But the bottom line, I had already focused on running out and going out and doing that new life so that I would be okay and everything would be okay. And here she was like, it's like the Godfather. Remember Godfather 3? And they pulled me back in again. Here I am now, and I felt like I had to go to marriage counseling because I was worried about what her parents might think. So I went to the marriage counselor, and he said something like this. He said to my former wife, he said, so Ronnie, what are the three things you want to change about Russell? And she said, well, I'd like him to come home for dinner, you know, at a reasonable time. I'd like him to maybe stop drinking. I'd like him to, whatever the hell else she said. I wasn't listening. And all I kept on thinking is, this is going to get me back into this thing, and I want to party, and I want to go to the bars, and blah, blah, blah. And he turned to me, he said, Russ, what are the three things you want to change with Ronnie? And I said, I just want to date other women. I'm looking at the face of this young lady, Karina, right here. You know, I didn't even think until many years later, when I was doing my A-step and things like that, the effect that has on somebody. I just wanted to tell you that story just in case you thought I was a nice guy. I'm an alcoholic. I'm not a nice guy. I used to pay my child support bills, so I'd tell myself I was a nice guy. I was civilized, and I was an attorney. I had a three-piece suit, so I told myself a nice guy. I never committed a felony or a crime, so I told myself I was a nice guy. I did a lot of things. I told myself I was an asshole. I was a selfish, self-centered jerk. And the bottom line is that, you know, I had some education, I had some money, I had a three-piece suit, I had some respect that other people would give me, but the bottom line is all I cared about was myself. I didn't give a crap about anybody else. I certainly didn't love anybody. It was all about, what do you think about, well, you know, what about me? It was all about me. Because you know what that is? That's about alcoholism, and it has nothing to do with drinking. Drinking is what you do in order to feel better and get rid of the alcoholism, because when you're an asshole, you have no right to feel good. You always feel bad and crappy about yourself. It has to do with your thinking. And you can't stop it just by thinking it away or trying to do the next right thing or any of that stuff. You got to have God. At least I had to have God's help. Because that's just the way my brain is formed. That's just the kind of guy I am, you know? So, Nathan, I continue to drinking, and one day I want to get past the drinking stuff and get into some sobriety stuff. And when I was around 30 years old, 31, let me see, I was 30, I was 31 years old, I thought my life was over. I couldn't stop drinking. You know, by the time you decide you need to stop drinking, you can't. You know, I don't know, has anybody here ever experienced the deal where you can't stop drinking? You know, you wake up in the morning, you say, I'm not going to have a drink today, and by 5 o'clock you're drinking anyway. You wake up in the morning and say, I'm not going to buy booze today, and by 5 o'clock you're scraping up dimes, nickels, and quarters so you can scrape up $2.89 and buy a quart bottle of Carlos Rossi Chianti. You say you're not going to drink again, you're not going to go to the bar today, and all of a sudden the car is turning by itself. You let go of the wheel. I would do this. I'd drive along I-95, and I'd say, I'd not go to the bar, and I'd let go of the wheel at 80 miles per hour, 70 miles per hour, and I'd say, well, I'll let God decide, and the car would always turn towards the bar. Well, it sort of looked like it was turning towards the bar. You know what I mean? And then I grabbed the wheel and I'd say, well, I guess God wants me to go to the bar. I could not stop drinking. I thought my life was over. I thought it was never. I wanted to stop, but I couldn't envision a life without drinking. I couldn't envision a life without drinking. And so one day you finally give up. You say, I'm an alcoholic. I'm never going to stop drinking. My life is over. You just go on to the bitter end. And I couldn't stop drinking. And one day, it was December of 1980, and I was living alone in my bachelor pad. I was going to become the UHAP in Miami. That was my plan, but through a couple of bad breaks and misunderstandings, it never actually came to fruition. And because apparently you got to stand up straight in order to do that, you know, and be able not to wobble. And I was, I had gone to what's called the Noche Buena, which is like a Christmas thing that, you know, Latins do down in Miami. Some gal had taken me there, and I got drunk by 7 o'clock at night, and, because I was a fast drinker, and I drank from the noble art of getting bombed. I couldn't stop. I was always getting drunk. And her father told me, he says, get rid of that guy because he's a drunk. And I thought everybody was drinking like I drank. I hung around with guys who drank like I drank. I thought, you know, everybody drank. I thought everybody got drunk. And they kicked me out, and it was Christmas. It was Christmas Day. It was 3 o'clock in the morning, and I was alone in my bachelor pad. Because that's where alcoholics wind up, alone. I don't even care if they're in a stadium, they're alone. And so I was sitting there alone, and it was 3 o'clock in the morning. I turned on TV, and I'll tell you, 2, 3 o'clock in the morning, you turn on TV, Christmas Day, I'll tell you what you get a preacher. And some guy was on TV talking about changing your life and, you know, whatever. He was giving his testimony like we give up here. You know, we call it our story. You know, our stories just go in a general way. What we used to be like, what happened, what we like now. Our stories are important. The most important thing we have is our story. He started telling me his story, the story of his life. And he sort of shared the way I remember it, like you share an AA, except his story was he accepted Christ in his life. He says, you want it? And I got down on my knees and I said the sinner's prayer and I accepted Christ in my life on my knees. Which may not seem like a big deal to you guys, but I was desperate. What may not seem like a big deal to you guys, but for a Jewish kid from Long Island, it was a big deal. It was. It was a big deal. And that just shows you, when you're desperate, man, I'll tell you, the one thing I can't give people, I can tell them all about my story, I can't give you the desire. When you're desperate and your desire to change your life, you know, I don't care whether you call it repentance, whatever. When your desire to change your life and become a different person and go a different way, I got down on my knees and I'll tell you something. I was serious. I said that prayer. I did that thing. I'd like to report to you that I immediately stopped drinking, that, you know, 15 rabbis and a priest showed up and with donuts and said, there's an AA meeting down the corner. That's not the way it is. I went to sleep. You know, I thought for many years, I thought nothing had happened, but something had happened. Something happened. A month later, I'd gotten into a car accident because I was drunk. Because I was a driving drunk. I was always driving drunk, you know, and I was always going through blackouts. I mean, I'll tell you, the funnest part of driving drunk is when you're going 70 miles per hour. You're going 70 miles per hour on the highway, and you all of a sudden come to, and you're wondering who's driving the car, and it's you. It kind of, you know, scares you a little bit. And I'll tell you something, and when you're so the bottom line is I got into a bad accident, almost killed myself and somebody else. And I looked up from that hospital gurney and I said, God, help me, and something happened to me. I'm one of those guys that had one of those spiritual experiences. I had an experience. I had something touched me. I can't tell you whether it lasted an hour, a week, or one day, or a nanosecond. But something, I had something come upon me, some sort of peace, and that's the deal. And a guy came to, visit me, and I looked up at the person and I said, I need help. I can't stop drinking. I didn't say my name is wrong. I'm Palos Rock all my life. I said, I need help. I can't stop. I said, I need help. I can't stop. You know, before I might have said, I need a girlfriend, I need money, I need my job back, I need this, I need that. And the only thing I said, all of a sudden it became absolutely clear to me that my life was unmanageable because I couldn't stop drinking. It was so clear. At a time of my life, I mean, the alcohol was probably still pumping through my veins. At a time of my life when nothing should have become clear to me, and I looked at somebody and I said, I need help. I can't stop drinking. Now, if I'd only known, what I was really saying is, I need God. But, you know, we're an alcoholic. That's the first segue into that deal. That's the first segue into that deal, knowing that you need help from somewhere and you can't stop drinking. And he came to tell me, I thought he was going to tell me, you know, about drinking. You know, listen, if you're going to talk to me about drinking, you know, you're going to tell me about drinking, you're going to say, you kidding me? People came to me drinking. He says, I would say, listen, I know you think I have a drinking problem, but I don't have a drinking problem. I drink because I have problems. As a matter of fact, my drinking perfectly matches my problems. So, I mean, one day my problems will go away and I won't have to drink anymore. So thank you very much for your advice, but why don't you go screw yourself? You know, just my, because if you're going to talk to me about my drinking, you better be prepared for me to talk about everything I know about you and your mother. You know what I mean? You're going to come at me, but it ain't going to be for free. And this guy knew how to do a 12-step call because he didn't talk to me about me. He talked to me about himself. And he told me what it was like for him, and I started identifying with him. And he said, then he said this, Russell, he says, you don't have to. He told me something I swear I had never heard before. I had never heard this before. I had people tell me, why do you drink the way you do? When are you going to stop drinking? You know, why are you doing this? Don't you see? I had all that crap happen to me, but I'd never had somebody say this to me. He said, Russ, you never have to drink again if you don't want to. See, I didn't know that. I thought I had a drink. I honestly thought I had a drink. And then he said the next thing. He says, you never have to feel this way again if you don't want to. And I didn't want to drink anymore. And I can't tell you how much I didn't want to feel the way I was feeling. And he took my first AA meeting. That's when I picked up my white chip. In Florida, that's what we do. I suppose you do that here. I picked up a white chip. And he became my first sponsor, Bob Sullivan. I've had three sponsors. Bob Sullivan, they died all sober, all had long-time sobriety. Bob Sullivan, Joe Snyder, and now my current sponsor has 58 years, and John Glenn. And been my sponsor, all big book guys, all believers, and all that sort of stuff. And they introduced me to other people like Ray O'Keefe. I've had many mentors in this thing, older mentors in this thing, big book guys, solution guys, into the big book guys. None of this fancy smanshy stuff or none of this group therapy crap. You know, in 1950s there was a great article written called. And, you know, I don't want to get preachy here or anything like that or, you know, controversial. Actually, I do, but that's okay. And I will. I had a great article called a Strong Cup of Tea. I'll send it to anybody who wants, where they discovered the unwritten secret in Alcoholics Anonymous that there's really two AAs. They discovered a long time ago that people can stay sober and not drink for 5, 10, 15 years and not work the steps. Just based on the fellowship, just hanging around AA rooms, drinking coffee instead of drinking beer and talking the same shit and feeling the same crap without changing, without working the steps. And once groups of alcoholics found out that you could stay sober just going to meetings and playing around and having a fellowship and, you know, doing the social thing and not drink, you know what I mean? And of course in AA, it's just put the plug in the drug. It's just, what do they give the medallions out for? Not drinking. I mean, you could be a pedophile. You could be on your 15th marriage. You can kill 15 priests and a rabbi. You know, your sponsor says, but did you have a drink? No, hey, you're a winner. You know what I mean? And, you know, I mean, that's what it's all about. So the bottom line is, once groups of alcoholics found out you didn't have to do any of this crap, you understand? And you say, you work your program, I'll work my program, and you don't have to do any of this crap and still not drinking. What do you think most of them opted to do? And so you really have sort of like two AAs. You got AA Light and you got AA Serious. And I wanted that rocket ship. I wanted that deal, what they said in the book. When it says in this book, first of all, we had to quit playing God. When you make this decision, take it seriously, all sorts of remarkable things happen. Being all powerful, he'll give you everything you need. Being all powerful, he's not the higher power, he's the highest power. Being all powerful, he'll give you everything you need if you stay close to him and perform his work well. Perform his work well. When am I going to get a girl? Does that have anything to do with his work? When am I going to get money? What does that have to do with his work? All sorts of remarkable things. You start losing fear of you start losing concern for your own plans and designs, your little plans. You start being concerned with how you can contribute to life. You know, fear of people, places, and things leave you. You lose fear today, tomorrow, the hereafter. You are reborn. You start having a God consciousness. You see how he's working in your life. That's the deal I wanted. I wanted the Al Kennedy deal. I wanted a deal when I was 3 months sober and I went to an AA meeting. There was some guy sharing in Al Kennedy. He's talking from the podium. You know, it says if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. Yeah, I had to have a we. I had to develop a we. You don't have a we. If you don't have a we, if you don't have a group of people or a man or a woman that you don't want what they have, then you're your we and you're thinking about what you want, what you have, and there's nobody you're looking at. And I started developing a we. I wanted to have what my sponsor Bob Sullivan had. I wanted to have what Al Kennedy had. And he was talking from the podium and he had about 30 years and he was helping people and I was looking at a guy, this guy was obviously a man. He's whatever my vision of a man was, this was it. He was comfortable in his own skin. He wasn't scared. I mean, he was talking without notes and, you know, I couldn't do it. He was just sharing his insights. He was transparent. You know, he was strong, but he wasn't arrogant. You know, he was loving, but he wasn't weak. And then he left and I turned to my sponsor and I said, man, that guy was great. It's almost like you want to hang out with him. You just feel better being with him. See, if I could only hang out with that guy, I'd be okay. And then he turned to me and this is what he said to me. He said, Russ, you know, he's dying of cancer. And I said, no, I'm talking about the guy who just shared, Al Kennedy. He says, yeah, he's dying. I said, what do you mean he's dying? You know, I used to go into discussion meetings, you know, I was a thumb-sucking crybaby. you know, whining about my, you know, what's happening to me and what's happening. What's, you know, all I hung around with people who was crying about all the crap in their lives. And he said, I didn't understand it. You know what I mean? He said he's dying. The guy just gave a great talk. He didn't mention anything about it. And he says he's dying. I thought he was talking about somebody else. I said, no. The guy who just did it, he says, yeah, he's dying of cancer. I said, the guy who just did it, he says he's dying of cancer. But he didn't say anything. He says, I know. He says, but he's dying of cancer. 3 months later, Al Kennedy was dead. Do you think I could wrap my mind about that? I didn't understand that at all, but it happened right in front of me. I saw it right in front of me. I saw a guy dying of cancer doing a meeting, didn't even mention about it. He was just trying to help other people. And I said, man, if I could have 10% of that drug, how do you get that deal? All I do is sit around worrying about my boss, my money, worrying about stuff from the wake up in the morning till I go to sleep at night. You know, what's going to happen to me? What's going to happen to this? How do you get that deal? I wanted the Al Kennedy deal. I wanted what that guy had. He became part of my way, and I became following guys like that around in Dade County. I know they don't have in Dade Broward. We have things called Step Series, where guys have 30, 35 years who are respected in Alcoholics Anonymous do 12-week sessions on the steps. They do lectures, and you get to go to see them. And they talk about how they did it and what they do, and they give these hour talks and everything. And I used to follow these guys around, just trying to see whether I can get close to them, maybe through osmosis, because I couldn't understand them. Because, you know, you can't understand alcohol. You know, your sponsors are crazy. I had abusive sponsors. I was looking for the guy. I was supposed to be sponsored by Albert Einstein or Jesus Christ. They were not available. And so they stuck me with this guy named Bob Sullivan, who never even graduated grade school. He was a used car salesman. He had about 20 years sobriety. I mean, I'm a lawyer. I'm a National Science Foundation fellow, going for Department of Honors in Mathematics, going for my doctorate in algebraic topology. You know what I mean? Studying differential equations and all sorts of crap, and they stick me with this guy who doesn't even graduate grade school. You know what I mean? And he used to say things to me. And I'm sensitive. And he used to hurt my feelings. I tell him I was sensitive. He'd say, no, Russ, great artist is sensitive. You're just touchy. One time I'm sitting in my office. I have this beautiful office, this large wall. It's got like 20, 30 plaques and diplomas and everything, attesting to how I've been educated far beyond my capacity to understand anything. And I said to him, Bob, these are my degrees. These are my degrees. And he looked at me and says, you know, Russ, rectal thermometers have degrees. You know what they do with those? How can you talk to a guy like that? I go up to him during a meeting. I talk to him how I don't have enough money to pay the mortgage. I got a wife and three kids. They're going to foreclose on the house. I don't know what to do about the money. And he looks at me and he says, you know, Russ, I think it's about time you start making coffee for the group. Now, one of us is crazy. You understand what I'm saying? Now, you got to understand, I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, I had two neurons working, you know, they were waving goodbye to each other, you know what I mean? But I wasn't doing too well. But I mean, by around 3 months sober, my mind was working overtime. Believe me, if there's anything going on in my life, I knew about it and I was focused on it and I was obsessed with it. And I'll tell you something, has anybody, you know, listen, you know when you're feeling, listen, has anybody ever had any anxiety here? No, serious, raise your hand if you ever had any anxiety, up to and including now, okay. Would I be correct in saying, now let me just guess on this, when you're anxious and you're upset about something, would I be correct in saying that you know why you're upset? You know why you're upset, right? I mean, if there's anything you know in this world, you know why you're upset, right? As a matter of fact, you probably go up to people, maybe at meetings or otherwise, and start telling them why you're upset. In detail, you tell them why you're upset. And when you're done with them and you wring them out like a sponge, you go up to the next person and tell them why you're upset. You just want to tell everybody why you're upset. You want to get your glee club together and say, yeah, man, you ought to slap that bitch. You know what I mean? I do the same thing. You know, I tell people. So I'm sitting there. I know why I'm upset. I know what the problem is. I know what would solve my problem. I need money. And he's saying, you know, it's about time you start making coffee for the group. And I'm thinking, there's no conversation going on here. We're like on different levels. This guy is obviously not bright enough to understand a brilliant guy like me. The guys in the bar would understand. But what am I going to do? The one thing I had going for me was I was scared shitless of drinking again. I didn't want to drink again. And I had somehow put together 3 or 4 months where I hadn't had a drink. And I knew he had something to do with it. As crazy it was, I knew that he had something to do with it. Because whenever I got crazy, I'd call him up and he'd say something. I'd feel better. I wouldn't drink. So I didn't want to lose him. So I started making the flipping coffee. And somehow the money thing worked out, and I was making the coffee for like 18 months. Guys would come up to me and he says, I'll make the coffee. And I says, that's my job. It's my job. Stay away from the coffee. You know what I mean? I don't understand it, you know, and that's, you know, one day I'm driving up. I want to tell the story because I think It's an important story. You know, there's a lot of stories, but this is important. I was driving up with Bob to pick up. Bob sponsored a guy named Bobby. Now, get this straight. You'll get mixed up. Bob sponsored me and another littermate I had named Bobby. I'm a white chip wonder. I picked up a white chip and never hadn't found necessary to have a drink, at least up until now. I haven't found necessary to have a drink, so I'm a white chip wonder. But Bobby was a guy who every 30 days, you know, he was one of these guys, like, he had like a timer. He would say things like, I'm coming on that time again. He says, you're an alcoholic, but I'm an alcoholic with that 30-day thing. I stay sober for 29 days on the 30th day, like that. You know what I mean? And, you know, and I'm watching Bobby, you know, and I am stark raving sober. You know, when you get sober and you're sober, you pay attention to everything that's going on. And I was watching it every 30 days. This guy would get drunk and my sponsor, we would drive up to Bark, you know, which was the detox center. We'd pick him up in Fort Lauderdale. Bob would pick Bobby up. We'd drive him back. He'd get him some more clothes. He'd set him up in a place. He'd take him to meetings and everything. And Bobby would be great. He'd be saying, I'm never going to do this again. Thank you very much. I'm going to do it differently now. And then 30 days later, like clockwork, he would drink again. And this had been going on for months. And now we're on like the 6th month. He'd done it 5 times already. And we're driving up to pick up Bobby. And I'm getting sick of it because I understand that my sponsor is, what can I say? He's not bright. He's not a bright man. You know, and I understand. Let me tell you something. I know people. If you're an alcoholic, you just know. Like I can tell assholes and idiots like that. I'd be sitting in a bar. Listen, I'd be sitting in a bar with a friend of mine. And I'd see a guy on the other end of the bar that I never even seen before, walking with a good-looking blonde, and I'd turn to my friend and I'd say, "Look at that asshole." Cuz you know. Because you just know, you know what I mean? You know, or driving a nice car, you just know when you're dealing with an idiot, you know what I mean? And they're all over the place, you know what I'm talking about? And so I knew this guy was a phony, he was a phony baloney, he was using my sponsor was too dumb to understand, and I'm an attorney, you understand, I'm an attorney, and he's not, you know what I mean? And, you know, that's why my wife doesn't know much, because I'm an attorney and she's not, you know, and in any event, so I'm driving up and I laid into him. I said, you know, Bob, you are crazy. You are stupid. This is stupid. This guy is an idiot. He's a phony. We did this last month. We did it the month before. We did it the month before that. We did it the month before that. He says the same thing. He never gets sober. He doesn't give a crap about you. He doesn't give a crap about me. This is all about me. He's wasting our time. We should go to a meeting. We should turn this thing around. I had the 3x5 cards. I had the photographs. I had everything. You know what I mean? I was right. I was so right. I was Alky right. If you disagree with me, you got to die because you're so stupid. You know what I mean? And so I was telling him all this stuff. And I'm going crazy. And I'm repeating myself. I'm doing what Alky's doing. I'm power-driven arguments. I'm repeating myself over and over again. And I finally, after 10 minutes, I sort of tuckered myself out. And I was tired. But, you know, now I had the group in my mind. And we were discussing things. You know what I mean? Kill him. Kill him. He's got to die, you know? And all that sort of stuff. And my sponsor turns to me. What could he say? Because you know what the truth is? I was right. No, I'm not kidding. I was right. Everything I said was correct. Everything I said was absolutely right. So what could he say? What could this guy who didn't even graduate elementary school say? And he looks at me and he says, Russell, I said, what? What? He said, Russell, I said, what? What? He said, Russell, I said, what is what? He says, are you done? I said, yeah, I'm done. He says, no, are you done? Yes, I'm done. I'm done. He said, Russell. I said, what? He said, Russell, listen. I said, what? What? And this is what he said. It doesn't bother me like it bothers you. It doesn't bother me like it bothers you. I looked at him and I said, how can it not bother you? Everything bothers me. Everything bothers me. And the problem was I wanted everything he had and he wanted nothing I had because he used to have what I had. It was called alcoholism. And if you're an alcoholic and you're not drinking, that's the shit you're suffering from. That's the problem. That's the real problem that centers in your mind. 9 years later, I'm doing step series all over Miami. I'm sponsoring people. I'm doing the deal. And I suppose there was some growth. 9 years later. What do they say in the sixth step? This is the step that separates the men from the boys. Repeated these things over many years to grow in the image and likeness of their Creator. 9 years later, I called my new sponsor, my first one to die, Joe Snyder. He had 30 years. And my wife, you know how she is. You know, I've already told you how she is with the selfish thing. She had done something. I don't know what it was. She had disrespected me. She had done something worthy of my ire. And I called him up and I said, you wouldn't believe it, my wife. You wouldn't believe what Dickie did. You wouldn't believe it. And I told him graphically, in detail, what she had done. She then said this, she did that, she spent this, she went over here, she did that, she did this, then she told me this, and she did this. I told in detail for 20 minutes. I hit her, I said, I can't believe this bitch, I didn't get married for this crap. You know, I'm not going through this. This is the Bible, this is over it. You know, that line. I went through the whole thing. And I was right. Let me tell you something. She was so wrong, and I was so right. It was unbelievable. It was wrong. What she did was wrong. And I laid it all out for him, and believe me, and I was pissed. And I knew why I was pissed. And I'll tell you something. If I was with one of my buddies in the bar, he wouldn't know why I was. I wouldn't put up with that crap. I'd slap that bitch. You know what I mean? She doesn't need that. Who the hell do you need that? What kind of guy? She doesn't, you know, and I was telling him all this stuff. And after I was done, he said to me, 9 years later, after I went through that whole thing and I laid it out for him, he says this. He said, so why are you upset? I said, what do you mean? He said, why are you upset? I said, I don't know what you're talking about. He says, why are you upset? I said, I just spent 20 minutes telling you why I'm upset. He said, I just spent 20 minutes telling you why I'm upset. Remember, we agreed that when you're upset, you know why you're upset. I mean, if there was one thing I knew, I mean, if there's one thing you know, if you're an alcoholic, if there's one thing you know why you're upset. Maybe not. He said, why are you upset? I said, I just spent 20 minutes telling you why I'm upset in detail. And then he says this. He says, that's not why you're upset. And I say, that's not why I'm upset. And he said, no, that's not why you're upset. I said, what I just told you, all that stuff I told you in detail, that's not why I'm upset. And he said, no, that's not why you're upset. And he shut up. Didn't say anything else. So, if there's one thing I'm interested in, is it's me. I mean, I've gone to psychiatrists all over the world because I want to know about me. And I want to find out about me. And when am I going to be okay? And why do I feel the way I do? And what's going on? So, you know, I got that. And that's, you know what that is, by the way? That's alcoholism. It can work for you, actually. Knowing about you and thinking about you and always worrying about you and want to know more about you. And that sort of thing will get you to ask the question, well, do you know why I'm upset? And then he says, because he knew he was dealing with an alcoholic, and I'm an alcoholic. And you know what that means? That means if you try to tell me what's wrong with me, I tell you to go screw yourself. So he made me beg for it. He said, you know why I'm upset? He said, yeah. I said, what are you going to tell me? And then he says, do you really want to know? I said, well, of course I want to know. Why am I upset? He said, listen, stupid. You're upset because you're upsettable. What is this, Zen AA? You know what he was telling me? He was telling me the same thing my first sponsor told me 9 years before that. We were driving up to get Bobby from the deal. And everything I had described to him that Bobby was about was absolutely true. We were both involved in the same exact life situation. You know what the master said? In this world you will have problems. But be of good cheer, I've overcome the world. We're involved in the same worldly situations that you will always be involved in, no matter how sober you are, no matter how long you're sober. We're involved in the same deal. Driving up to get Bobby, who really didn't give a crap, who probably would never get sober, who maybe was a phony baloney. And you know what he said to me? This is what he said to me. He said, Russell, it doesn't bother me like it bothers you. He's saying, you're upsettable. You get upset at these things. It doesn't bother me. 9 years later, I had barely touched that deal. I had barely touched that deal. You know, and if you can't touch that deal, then the world will always have you by the hoosets. Your life and how you feel about yourself will always depend upon your outward circumstances. You'll feel good if you have money. You'll feel bad if you don't have money. You'll feel good if you're in a relationship. You'll feel bad if you're not in a relationship. And if you are in a relationship, if your partner's not doing well or something happens, you'll go down the tubes. Everything will be unhealthily dependent upon other people, places, and things. It'll all be about buying a new blouse, getting a new haircut, dyeing your hair, doing this, doing that. It'll all depend upon everything that's going on about you and what's happening. It'll never depend upon what's actually going inside of you, because what's going on inside of you is a person who's out to destroy themselves because they feel like shit. And there's no inner anything going on because you've got that alcoholism and you're still suffering from the consequences of this deal. And so I continue to work this thing, and I've done a lot of stuff. There's been a lot going on. So, I remember my sponsor would come up to me. A lot of training goes on in this deal. It's good to have a really good sponsor, a tough sponsor. I had my sponsor. One time I went up to him. I said, I can't believe I was talking about a guy who bounced a check on me. A $500 check. And I'm going nuts. I can't believe he finds I got to kill him. This guy bounced a $500 check. And he said, he looks at me and I'm going crazy. And he says, well, let me ask you something. I said, what? He says, how would you feel if it didn't bother you? I said, because these guys are stupid, stupid shit, He says, how would you feel if it didn't bother you? I said, what are you talking about? Because it's like talking to a guy from Mars, really, they're really stupid. I said, what do you mean? He says, well, how would you feel if it didn't bother you? I said, what do you mean, how would I feel if it didn't bother you? How would you feel if it didn't bother you? What do you mean? How would it feel if it didn't bother me that he bounced a $500 check on me? He says, yeah, how would you feel if it didn't bother you? How would I feel if it didn't bother me that he bounced a $500 check on me and it caused me to bounce checks? He says, yeah. How would you feel if that didn't bother you? He says, well, if it didn't bother me, I guess I'd feel okay. He said, there you go. And he walked away. One time I was telling him and I was yelling at him about something that was going on and I couldn't pay the rent and this was going to happen, that's going to happen. And we were eating lunch or something like that. And he said, well, let me ask something. How are you doing now? I said, what do you mean? He says, well, how are you doing now? I said, what do you mean, how am I doing now? He says, well, how are you doing now? I said, what do you mean, how am I doing now? He says, how are you doing right now? I said, what do you mean, right now? He says, right now. I said, what do you mean, right now in this restaurant, eating my soup? He says, yeah, how are you doing right now, eating your soup? How's your soup? Soup's fine. He says, how are you doing right now? He says, well, right now? He says, right now. He says, right now I'm fine. He says, there you go. I mean, this is how you get trained. And you get that happening to you maybe 10,000 times over a period of 20, 25 years. One day you wake up and all of a sudden you realize that you've been feeling good for months, for years. And all of a sudden you realize that things aren't bothering you and you can't even determine when it happened. All of a sudden your wife is saying, I have guys that follow me around, my sponsees, and all they do is complain about their wives. And they come over to me and my wife is there and she says something to me. Who knows what she says? You know how they are. They say, you're the worst husband, you never take out the garbage, whatever the heck it is, whatever she says, I can't believe how selfish you are. Whatever they say, they say stuff, they want, to get attention, whatever the heck that, whatever's going on there, she says, well, they say what they say, you know what I mean? And she says something and they look at me and I say, okay, honey. And whatever, and he says, or they say, did you hear what your wife just said? And I said, no, what'd she say? Or whatever. Because I said, her moods don't bother me anymore. Unless I can do something to help it out, because they come, they go. I know 90% of the time it's not about me, it's just about a feeling that she has, and I'm the biggest, loudest guy, I'm the biggest guy in the room. I mean, if you're a husband and your wife's not feeling well, you do have to, it is your fault. It is my fault. Of course it's my fault. Who else is here except for me? I plead guilty. I don't go to trial. I say, honey, I plead guilty. I just want, let's go straight to the penalty phase. It's always like a blouse or dinner, I mean, it's not something I can't afford, Or she says, well, I can't talk to you, what I mean? They're always saying I'm right, And I mean, life is so much easier when you're not fighting people all the time, when you're not at war, when you're not trying to defend yourself. There's nothing that makes a person who feels secretly inadequate feel worse than being treated like you're secretly inadequate, by being put down or anything like that. Why do I have to defend myself? I know who I am. And the reason I know who I am, and I'll end with this, is the reason I know who I am is only because of faith. I'm not going to go into a long thing because we're out of time right now, but as my faith has increased in this program, for a lot of reasons, and God, and being more concerned about what God thinks about me, my higher power, who I choose to call God, like they talk about him in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the less I'm concerned with what you think about me. I just do a lot better when I'm focused on him instead of focusing on me and you. So God bless you. Thank you very much.